Luke 16, page 1054. He also said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Tell in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager. And the manager said to himself, what shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am not ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses. So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, and how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the son of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, receive you into the eternal dwelling. One who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful with the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful with that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money.
Let's just pray first of all before we come to this section of the Bible. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for the wise and incisive words of your lovely Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. We pray that you would help us as we come to think about these words that he spoke, that you would give us wisdom and help as we do that, so that we would understand and be able to apply to our own hearts the truth that you would have us to. We ask it for his dear name's sake. Amen. Well, if you're a visitor here tonight, you're in good company, because so am I in a way. The folks here in the church in Christchurch Central have been doing a series over the summer months entitled Are You Sitting Comfortably? And we're looking at some of the parables or stories that Jesus told in the Gospels. And over the summer months, I suppose it doesn't matter if you go on holiday, because the series kind of hangs together, but it doesn't really matter if you miss one. You're not kind of losing the flow. I've been asked to speak on this section of the Bible, Luke chapter 16, the parable of the dishonest manager. You've heard something about my background, and I think the Americans call what I'm doing bivocational, serving as a pastor part-time and also trying to run a business as well part-time. I've half suspected that the person who does the scheduling knows something of my background and has asked me to speak on this passage deliberately because they know something about my business dealings. I don't know about that. Try to keep that to the back of my mind. But the real issue here with this story is that it really is one of the most difficult to understand stories that Jesus ever told. And I think that's partly because the story itself has got some unusual twists in it. But it's also because Jesus in verses 8 down through 13 makes a number of different applications, and I think we really need to work very hard to get the big idea, the unifying idea of what Jesus is really driving at when he tells this story. So we've got a lot to get through in a short time, so I hope you are sitting comfortably. We're going to begin by dipping into the story. We'll try and clarify what the story is about by asking a couple of questions. And then I want us to look at verses 8 to 13 to get the gist of Jesus' application here to his own disciples. And we're going to finish by hopefully helping one another to think about what a personal response to this section might look like. So that's where we're going to go. If you're a sad old like me, one of the crass but compelling TV shows this year has been The Apprentice. I don't know if you watched The Apprentice, or maybe you wouldn't own up to it, I don't know. I'm sure you're familiar with the format. A group of people brought together who've applied for a job with Sir Alan Sugar, and he puts them through their paces. Every week there's a different business task, and at the end of it, someone hears the chilling words from Sir Alan Sugar, "You're fired." And by the end, there's one person left standing, and they hear the encouraging words, "You're hired." And if what happened this year was, I'm led to believe that the person who got hired was so tired after the interview process that he didn't turn up for work on the first day because he was so ill, which is not a great start with Sir Alan Sugar, is it? But the way Jesus sets the scene here reminds me of the chilling word Sir Alan Sugar, "You're fired." I think that's where this story starts, verse 2. Someone basically dobs this guy into his boss. And in verse 2, the boss thinks for a moment and then says, "Sorry, mate, sort the accounts out. You're fired. Get your coat. I'll have your P45 ready. You've finished your employment with me." That's really where this story starts. It's the manager's turn to think then. He thinks for about a nanosecond and then starts to panic. And he says in verse 3, "What am I going to do? My master's taking the management away from me. I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm too ashamed to beg." And then eureka. The light comes on. It comes to him. "I know what I'll do." And he calls in all his boss's customers and slashes their bills. Nice. I'm glad he doesn't work for me. The master unusually commands this guy. And that really brings us to our first question, because it seems on the surface that Jesus is saying that dishonesty pays. Is Jesus saying through this story that dishonesty is a good thing? Because the master commends this guy, Jesus seems to imply that this guy has done a good thing. And I think this question is the key to understanding what's going on here. On the surface, it seems that the bad guy becomes the good guy. He rips off his boss. And both the master and Jesus seem to think that that's a great idea. Let's use an illustration to clarify what's going on for us. I don't know if you're a film buff. There was a film trilogy that's come out over the last few years. I'm not exactly sure when the first one came out. But the first one in the series was called Ocean's 11. It's really originally a crime caper that starred Frank Sinatra. But this time round, George Clooney. I think we've got a picture of him. George Clooney, Brad Pitt. I don't know if this is a film that you've seen, but it's a film really all about criminals who steal things. I won't spoil the plot for you, but I've seen this film and enjoyed it, and I know a lot of other people who've seen this film and enjoyed it, but I haven't met anyone who came out of the cinema and watched this film thinking that being a criminal is a good thing. George Clooney plays a guy called Danny Ocean. And he and his group of 11 mates plan to steal $150 million from a casino owner. There are three rules. No one should get hurt. They only rob people who deserve robbing. And the third rule was, do it like you've got nothing to lose. Three reasonable rules, if you're a criminal. By the end, you're left thinking, wow, did they really pull that off? And you come out of the cinema not thinking, I'm going to be a criminal. The thing that you admire, really, I know it's kind of far-fetched, is the ingenuity, the cleverness, the wittiness of what the guys in the film do. You come out saying, wow, that was the perfect crime. But it doesn't make you want to become a criminal. And maybe the connection for us with that, with this story, is that at first glance, Jesus seems to use this story to commend basic dishonesty. But look again at verse 8. Towards the end of verse 8, the master commended the dishonest manager for what? His shrewdness. He isn't commending him for being a criminal. He's commending him for his ingenuity, his cleverness. Here's a man, and Jesus is really saying, you've got to love this guy. Here he is, back to the wall, staring down the barrel, and just look at what he does. Is that clever or what? That seems to be what Jesus is saying. He isn't commending the guy for being a liar or for being dishonest. He's really drawing attention to the fact that this guy was very, very shrewd. I think the second question for us to ask then is, why is it then that Jesus doesn't just tell a different story, a simple story, that demonstrates the principle of shrewdness? Why does Jesus not just tell a simpler story? I think part of the answer to that is that it would be boring. And when we understand the stories Jesus tells, they could never be described as boring. There's often a twist, and this man's shrewdness, I think, is a particular brand of shrewdness. Let's get back to the story and dig a little bit deeper. It's perhaps hard for us to understand fully what's going on unless we kind of understand the culture that Jesus lived in. This is not Canary Wharf or Wall Street or the stock market. This is really Totley Hall Farm, isn't it? I don't know if Chris Pocock's here. I haven't seen him tonight. Is he away? Chris Pocock. This is Totley Hall Farm. This is not a financial market. This is a farming economy. And it seems pretty obvious at the beginning that this boss here is a landowner, and he has a manager who's effectively an agent who manages his affairs on his behalf. And the land is most probably rented out, and the tenants are farmers. They can harvest the land, and they probably pay a kind of commission from the crops that they harvest to the boss who owns the land. And that's the deal. This manager, the agent, is incompetent. In a culture that prides itself on making money, someone tips off his boss that he's basically been wasting the boss's stuff. And the key to this, I think, is that this man is not dishonest in the first part of the story. I think if he was swindling his boss, the story would be that the boss would sue him for embezzlement. He doesn't do that. I think this guy's just rubbish at his job. And the boss calls him in and says, "You're wasting my stuff. It's time for you to take your P45. You're fired." And he's off. But if he's not dishonest in his job, why is he then described as dishonest in verse 8? Because the master seems to commend him. If he's ripping off the boss in the second half of the story, why does the master seem so pleased about that? Well, as I've studied this over the last period of time, I can't tell you how much nonsense has been written about this passage. Bizarre theories about what's going on here. And I'm going to give you another one. So here's my take on what's going on here. This is not necessarily the case, but it'll help us get the twist that Jesus puts on this story. I think one plausible explanation of what's going on here is that this manager obviously realises that he's losing his job. And it comes down to him. He's got one last chance to make his future safe. He's utterly broken, staring down the barrel, as we said. But you know that kind of fight or flight thing. He can't afford to put his head in the sand. He can't run away. He's got nowhere to hide, nowhere to go. And he musters all of his personal resources, all of his ingenuity. Think. You can imagine him saying to himself, "Think, man, think." And then it comes to him, "I know." And he calls in all the tenants one by one and discounts their fees. I think the subplot here is possibly that he tells the tenants that the boss is feeling generous. It's been a bad year. The crops aren't particularly good this year. And the boss is willing to revise all the amounts downwards. He's also pretty clever, because you notice that he didn't change the books himself, but he actually got the tenants to change the ledger. So he can't be accused of fiddling. What you've got now is a whole region of Chris Pocock style barn dancers going on. Everyone in the whole region thinks this guy's a great guy. What a guy. His generosity, his reputation for generosity is sky high. And you've got people coming up to the street maybe with tears in their eyes saying, "You've no idea what you've done. Thank you, this year's been such a difficult year. And you've really let us off the hook. You're such a great guy." He now reverses what his agent has done. It'll be like taking the toys off the kids at Christmas, won't it? And his reputation for generosity is shot to pieces. So the manager gets away with it, and the boss has to stand back and say, "I don't like it. It's cost me money. He's already cost me money because he's been a wastrel. And now I've just got to stand back and say, that is cute. That is very clever. He ripped him off in a way that he couldn't fix. I think maybe that's something along the lines of what's going on here. Whatever the issue, the main point of the story is that this man is not just shrewd, he is instinctively and desperately shrewd. He is what we would describe as a survivor, isn't he? That's it. He's a survivor. That's what he's commended for. He's not a particularly nice chap. He's not been very good at his job. And when the chips are down, he wastes even more of his manager's money. But what he is a survivor. That is why I think in verse 8, the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. You've got to stand back and admire his cleverness, even though you might not condone his dishonesty. There's a lot in the next verses after that. Where does Jesus take that? Let's try and break it down, verses 8 to 13 here. And I've grappled with this a little bit. Most commentators that I've read identify four different applications here. So we could be here till Tuesday if we kind of take those one by one. I suppose the thing that has bugged me is really verse 14 that we didn't read. Jesus here in this section is speaking to his disciples. I want you to notice that. But there are a group of men who are eavesdropping on this conversation. And in verse 14, the Pharisees, effectively the religious ruling party, who were lovers of money, heard all these things and they sneered. Do you get that in verse 14? And I just think that somehow the received wisdom on this section, when you read commentators who talk about nice kind of applications here, somehow for me they don't sound offensive. And when Jesus gets to verse 13, these Pharisees heard something that offended them very deeply. I think it's very easy, you know, to take the words of Jesus and to translate them and to replay them in a way that is lame. And we take the sting out of what Jesus says, strip it of its power, if you like. And I'm not sure that there's four applications here. I want to suggest that it will help us to see one key, profound application here that is stunning and provocative and radical and very countercultural. Countercultural? Countercultural. You know what I mean? And then to see that Jesus goes on, I think, to give two keys as to how that single application can work out in our lives. Is that clear? One application and two keys. So let's have a think. I think in verse 8 and 9 we'll find the one application. The big theme here, the unifying theme behind all these comments of Jesus, is that our attitude towards money is an undeniable and unavoidable test of where our hearts really are. That is really the big theme in this section, because it shows what we're really in love with. And what we love will ultimately determine our destiny. The main application then here, let's tune into verse 8 and 9. The first thing that I want to say from verse 8 is be instinctive. Be instinctive. The first thing to see in verse 8, the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. And then Jesus begins to apply straight away, halfway through verse 8. And he says something very shocking, really. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light are. I don't know if you can get the sense of this being impolite. Jesus is speaking here to his followers and he's effectively saying, I wish you were like that. Did you see what this guy just did? Did you see how instinctively, how energetically, how desperately he did what he did? In comparison, you guys look like you've nodded off. The sons of this world are more shrewd than you are. That isn't very polite, is it, as a kind of opening application? People in the world are more decisive than you. This bad guy puts you to shame. He doesn't even have a good motive, apart from the fact that he's been fired. But look at his energy and his determination and his ingenuity. Compared to him, you don't look shrewd at all. This man knew that his neck was on the line. He knew he was accountable. He knew he had nowhere else to go. And he instinctively and naturally summoned up all his resources to do something. Jesus is saying, I don't want you to do what he did, but I do want you to emulate his instinctive sense of energy and proactivity. Be instinctive. Jesus rebukes them in verse 8. The twist is that Jesus wants them to be like this man, but not do what this man did. So verse 9. I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. Here's the twist. Be instinctive, but generous. This man in the story, I'm sure you would agree with me, was instinctively self-serving. He had nowhere to hide. He needed to save his own skin. But Jesus isn't just giving a lecture here about survival instincts, like Bear Grylls. He is saying, I want you to be this dynamic and this instinctive and this natural and this determined and this alert and this awake, not to save your skin, but in being generous. I think Jesus here is focusing our minds, all of our minds, on what our underlying motives are. You get that? What our inner underlying kind of motives behind the reason we do things. And I suggest to you that he's raising the bar very, very high here. Jesus is saying, I don't want you to be grudgingly generous. I don't want you to be generous in a hesitant, self-serving kind of way. I want you to be open-handed, unflinchingly and unhesitatingly open-handed. Not because you're trying to gain something, but because that's what you really are in your heart. I want you to be like this guy, instinctive, but not to save your skin, but to serve others. I want you to emulate this guy's desperate instinct, but in being generous. I want generosity to be your natural default instinct. Is that a challenge? Another way of saying this would be to say, why do people in the world care so much about what they can get, and you guys care so little about what you can give? Is that the twist that Jesus is putting there on that verse? These guys are more awake than you are. I hope you don't miss the ironic twist here, that this is a word for everyone. What I mean by that is that some people think that God is pleased with religious people who on the outside look like they're being generous. But actually, Jesus raises the bar here much, much higher and questions not so much what we do, but why we do it and what we really are in our hearts. So someone who looks the part but isn't really and truly and instinctively generous is in for a big surprise. And the clever twist here is that Jesus uses this scoundrel of a waster, of a rascal, of a serving kind of guy, the kind of guy that a religious person would say, I'm not talking to him, to make the very point that he's making. That's the twist that's there. Let's kind of double check why the focus here is on generosity. Jesus goes on to make a second connective application in verse 9 that's part of this general be instinctive and be generous. He makes a very interesting statement here. This man had in the story had an eye on the future, didn't he? He has his eureka moment. He slashes the bells so that he'll get another job, so that people will be his friends. There's a future dimension to his kind of instinctive behavior. And Jesus takes that and he uses it and twists it and turns his disciples' minds towards the future and says something very, very strange. I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. Can I say very clearly that Jesus here is not talking about us being able to buy our way into heaven? We understand that, don't we? He's not talking about bribing God by being generous. What does he mean? Here's a thought for you. Jesus is saying here, I think, you should so live now in this world that when you get to the gates of heaven, there will be people there ahead of you who are there because of your instinctive generosity. And they'll fling open the doors and they'll welcome you in with trumpets and party poppers, I don't know. That the entrance that you get into heaven will be predicated on people being there who are there in part because of the generosity that you've shown. I think that's what Jesus means here. He says that in verse 9, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. He isn't talking about bribing God. He's talking about getting to heaven and taking people with you. If you want some summer homework, this thought is this isn't the only place in the Bible where this thought comes. If you 2 Peter chapter 1 verse 11, the same thought, a red carpet entrance into heaven based on the fruitfulness of a life lived on earth. So Jesus is saying here, I want you to be instinctive, but I want you to think long term. If you're thinking about a pension plan, you ain't thinking long term enough. I want you to think now about how are you investing your resources today to make sure that other people will be in heaven with you. To a Christian person tonight, Jesus would say, I want you to invest in the gospel. I want you to be thinking not so much about your own skin, but about how you can bring about eternal well-being to those around you. And invest your resources generously, instinctively, naturally, dynamically, alertly in that end game. That is radically countercultural. I want you to so live in this world, fully immersed in this world, awake and alert and instinctively outward looking with an eye on the eternal well-being of others. That, according to Jesus, is real shrewdness. Investing yourself, your life and your stuff in other people. Those of you who are followers of Jesus tonight, I know many of you are, can I ask you, what kind of entrance do you expect to receive in heaven? Will you have to sneak around the door somehow? Kind of creep in, no one will really notice? Or will you have so used your resources here and now that there'll be a massive party when heaven's door opens and there'll be people there who owe their salvation in part to things that you did for them here? It's a challenge, isn't it? I think on reflection that is the big idea here. Be instinctive and be generous. Invest your resources in others. The gospel. Two keys then, very quickly, before we just think about a response to this. First of all, Jesus, key one in verses 10 down to 12 is a question really. Whose stuff is it anyway? It's a good question for us to think about, isn't it? Jesus reminds his disciples in verse 9 that money doesn't last forever when he says when it is gone. In verse 10 to 12 he seems to pick up on this idea of the manager being a steward, doesn't he? He is really handling the boss's stuff on the boss's behalf. And Jesus, the stuff is really given to this manager on trust, and he wasted it. The implication is for the disciples of Jesus that God is their boss and he has given them good things. And the stuff they have, therefore, isn't really theirs. It's given to them on trust for them to use. They are really stewards of the things that God has given to them. So the first key that Jesus teaches here is that we need to remember that our resources are not really ours at the end of the day. They're his. That's radical, isn't it? Every part of our nature cries out, but that's mine. Jesus says, no, it isn't really yours. It is given to you. How are you going to use it? I came across a story which is a bit twee. I think it's American. Maybe that's what makes it twee, I don't know. A story of a man who had some assets in oil fields in America, and one day his company hit an oil field under the ground, and suddenly this guy was worth twice as much as he was before. And a couple of days later, a friend asked him, what's it like to wake up in the morning to be worth twice as much as you were yesterday? And the man, who was a Christian, said, my assets haven't changed. I didn't own the first, and I don't own the second. The responsibility now to God is to manage what he's given me wisely. It's twee, but it makes the point. If we can't manage what God has given us now to bless other people, how can he trust us with substantial, eternal riches? Jesus is saying then that the first key here is to be free from the grip of selfish, possessive attitudes towards our stuff. Sometimes I think we fall into the trap of thinking, well, we'll maybe put away enough. And when we're safe and comfortable, then we'll start to be generous. There was a survey done in 1992, and people were asked how much money they would have to earn to be happy. And there was a bunch of people who earned £15,000 a year, and they thought that they would need to earn £30,000 a year to be really happy. But there was another bracket of people who earned £50,000 a year, and they thought they would need to earn £100,000 to be truly happy. That says something, doesn't it, about human nature? We typically think we need twice as much as we've got for us to be content. Jesus says key one is, whose stuff is it anyway? Key two, very quickly before we close, Jesus in a way asks a very provocative question here. He really asks the question, where is your heart? Jesus reminds his followers that they can't serve two masters. Verse 13, it's a logical impossibility. No servant can serve two masters, for either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. And the killer punch, you cannot serve both God and money. One of them has to be subordinate to the other. There's a comedian in America, I don't know if you've heard of him, called Jack Benny. He's dead now, but he was the forerunner of modern sitcoms that we watch on TV. He appeared on television, and he played in character a miser. He was known as being as tight could be. And a lot of the gags were kind of based around his kind of miserliness. On one occasion in one of the shows, he's accosted by a robber. And the robber comes up to him, puts a gun to his head and says, your money or your life. And Jack Benny freezes. And again the robber says, come on, your money or your life. And Jack Benny says, I'm thinking. He's a miser. Money or your life. That's often where we are though, isn't it? Do I have to choose? Maybe I'll choose tomorrow. Maybe I'll choose next week. Jesus cuts right to the chase and asks, today? No, even tonight. Where's your heart? What do you love the most? Jesus is showing here that true religion is really not so much about keeping rules. It is really about God being enough. It is about trusting him to satisfy and provide for us all that we need, rather than making money or possessions the ultimate thing and striving to achieve them outside of him. The moment we choose to love something else, we're really saying that God isn't enough, aren't we? But this thing will make me happy. When we make good things that God gives to us ultimate things, when we put things in front of him, it shows where our heart is, doesn't it? It shows that that's what we really love. And that is ultimately what defines us. And it's ultimately what will determine our destiny. Time's almost gone. Let me just help us to think through two personal responses. The first one is in verse 14. Hopefully we can see now why what Jesus says here causes such a reaction. If ever there was a group of men who could live up to religious rule keeping, it was the Pharisees. If ever there was a group who embodied striving to be lily white, morally upstanding, respectable citizens, it was those guys. You or I couldn't touch them for religious zeal. When they hear the teaching of Jesus, you would expect them to be jumping up and down. Here's something else we can do. Here's another rule we can keep. But what is their reaction? Their reaction in verse 14 is that when they heard all these things, they ridiculed him. Why? Because they loved money and were gripped, and it stopped them from seeing Jesus for who he really is. They were mixed up because they loved money but wanted to look like they really loved God. Jesus wasn't even talking to them, but he touched the raw nerve and he rebukes them sharply. You try and justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts are rotten because they're really in love with the wrong things. If we had more time, we could follow this through the rest of the chapter. I think the second story about the rich man and Lazarus drives this home even more. But is that your response tonight? Secret ridicule? We need to be warned, don't we? Jesus says loving good things in a way that turns them into ultimate things is what makes us ugly in God's eyes. We are beneath what we were meant to be when we sink to loving things more than we love him. It's a serious business, far greater than religion. Self-centeredness is not what we were made for, and it always ends in tears. Second response, and then we're done. Not ridicule, but repentance. It's a Bible word. The truth of this story, I think, is that we can't really live up to these ideals because, like this man, we are instinctively self-centered. I want you to understand that Jesus here is not saying, be like this and I'll accept you. Because we'd never make it, would we? I wouldn't. He is saying, this is what you ought to be like, but you're not. But the good news of the gospel is that this is exactly what I'm like. I am instinctively generous. And I also take a long-term view of your well-being. And it's natural to me to lay aside all the glory that I had in heaven before I was born in Bethlehem and to come into this world to suffer, ultimately to die. Because I love you, even though you love the wrong things. That's the beauty of the gospel. Not that we can do this in our own strength, because we can't. But we have a Saviour who loves us, who is like this. Instinctively generous and has our long-term well-being in view. The key issue tonight is making a response to him, turning from a self-centered life and coming home to trust him, trusting that he accepts you, that he's died to save you, and allowing him to be at work in your heart to liberate you so that you can love God and serve others gladly as you've been created to do. So tonight, will you sneer and hold your stuff tightly and ultimately lose everything? Or will you come home, hold your stuff loosely, and ultimately gain everything? Let's close with the words of Jesus in Matthew 6. That should come up on the screen for us. Do not store up for yourself treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasure in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.